You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
Welcome, everybody, and happy Thursday afternoon to each and every one of you. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. We have a ton of news that has happened in the last 24 hours. We're going to get to all of it. But our special focus on this program today, in conjunction with J.D. Vance's appearance to, try to sell regular working people who have bosses and receive paychecks, that the big brutal bill actually won't brutalize them. In conjunction with J.D. Vance's PR stop in La Crosse today, peddling more of the Trump administration's lies about how the big brutal bill will actually end up impacting working families across the state of Wisconsin and beyond. In conjunction with that appearance today, we've got three extraordinarily special guests joining us throughout the program this afternoon. We're first going to be joined in just a little bit, around 4:20, by Heidi Scherholz. She is the director of the Economic Policy Institute, and we're going to be talking about what the brutal bill is doing to places like Wisconsin, whose economy is driven by manufacturing and agriculture. At 5 o'clock, we'll be joined by Alex Jaquez, Chief of Policy and Advocacy at Groundwork Collaborative, and he is also a former White House National Economic Council official. In between those two fine guests, we will also be joined by one of our special guests from the Center for American Progress Action Fund, talking about workers' rights in advance of Labor Day. Don't be fooled by the vice president's, overly generalized statements that, of course, all of this will be just peachy. It won't, and we will discuss this afternoon. But let's stick with some of the breaking news first. Democratic candidate for governor, Lieutenant Governor Sarah Rodriguez, today called for the resignation of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. as United States Secretary of Health and Human Services, citing his long record of promoting conspiracy theories and undermining science. She had this to say, quote, "As a nurse and former Epidemic Intelligence Service officer at the CDC, I've worked in emergency rooms, on the front lines of epidemics, and in leadership roles making life or death decisions. I know real public health leadership, and I know it must be grounded in science, not conspiracy and ideology. He must resign or be fired before more trust is destroyed and more lives are lost. Families in Wisconsin deserve better than to be caught in the crossfire of the conspiracies and chaos coming out of Washington." This coming in these crazy days where it seems like the Centers for Disease Control are simply it is imploding before our eyes. It has been an incredibly confusing period of 24 hours. We broke some news late yesterday afternoon that the director of the CDC, the then director of the CDC, a woman by the name of Dr. Montez had either been fired or resigned. Her lawyers then retracted that, said she hadn't been fired. They asserted that she needed to be fired by the president himself. A very, very confusing period of time. It's CDC, former CDC Director Susan Monterez. This then led to a cascading of resignations at the CDC, four top officials resigning. This is on top of resignations that happened earlier this year in light of some of the, in their words, policies that RFK Jr. has put forward that are simply not based in any science, that are based in unreliable analyses. Some of the doctors accusing RFK Jr. of not providing the science that he was claiming support his new policy that will restrict the COVID vaccine access for this upcoming COVID and flu season, right as everybody's going back to school. We're going to cover that in great detail later on this program. In addition, overnight, Russia pummeling Kyiv with many bombs. This, of course, I'm going to call it just days after the quote-unquote peace summit. How's that working for you, Donald Trump? Looks like Vladimir Putin is doing just what you want him to, huh? Not so much. And I also wanted to revisit the Minneapolis tragedy of yesterday, because I was moved by a post by Fred Gutenberg, who's been a guest on this program. Fred Gutenberg on X pointed out what is some of the most disgusting hypocrisy and frankly just stupidity of some from the MAGA movement when it comes to this kind of killing of our children, which is preventable. If you don't recall Fred, and when he's been on this program, Fred was the father of a daughter, is the father of a daughter that perished in the Parkland school shooting in Florida years ago. And he has become a reasonable gun regulation advocate trying to promote safety in our schools. Fred reposted a X post from Representative Andy Auglis, who for his holiday greetings to his constituents this past December, posted a photograph of him, his wife, and his three children, all of them except the youngest child, holding rifles with what looked like quite large magazines. And Mr. Gutenberg pointed out that Representative Auglis, despite, you know, his full hug of gun rights, quote unquote, had this to say yesterday in response to the shooting. This is Representative Auglis. "Please join me in praying for the victims of this horrific evil that took place at Annunciation Catholic Church." Wow. Fred asks us this: "Please join me in a commitment to fire those like Representative Auglis who offer prayers while pushing a culture of gun violence that results in school shootings." I also wanted to point this out. Donald Trump appointed a guy named Thomas Fugate III in charge of the Department of Homeland Security's main hub for terrorism prevention, which includes control of an $18 million grant designed to help communities prevent violent extremism. It's called the Center for Prevention Programs and Partnerships, or CP3. The CP3 program is supposed to be responsible for, quote, "nationwide efforts to prevent hate-fueled attacks, school shootings, and other forms of targeted violence," end quote. That according to ProPublica. Well, Mr. Fugate is a 22-year-old former intern who, upon getting this appointment, fired 75% of his staff. He has no experience in national security. And now the CP3 is down to some 20 employees. Wow. And Mr. Fugate III pivoted the CP3 program away from combating domestic violence and extremism towards drug cartels and border security. Well, that's working out well, isn't it? And more of the nonsense from the GOP came today in response to the Minneapolis shooting from none other than Vice President J.D. Vance himself in La Crosse. Let's take a listen to what the Vice President said to the crowd in La Crosse on the Minneapolis shooting. Cut eight, or that cut I think is really, nine. Go ahead, sorry.
That I think is really worth taking a look at, because this happens too much in our country. And if you look, we really do have, I think, a mental health crisis in the United States of America. We take way more psychiatric medication than any other nation on earth. And I think it's time for us to start asking some very hard questions about the root causes of this violence. And I'm going to be part of that. And the First Lady and the President are going to be part of that. But that's going to be an American conversation that we're going to have together.
An American conversation about a problem would begin with an honest assessment of what is leading to this kind of violence, and an honest assessment of what leads to this kind of violence that makes our children unsafe in the churches in which they worship and the schools in which they learn are obviously the guns, and a culture that celebrates gun violence, which has been one of the core pillars of not just the MAGA movement, but the Republican establishment for decades. And you don't have to take my word for it. one of the most conservative chief justices of the Supreme Court, knew that this was all a scam, that this pounding the table about the Second Amendment has nothing to do with people's freedoms or rights, but is in and of itself a fraud. Here is former Chief Justice Warren Burger talking about the Second Amendment decades ago. Take a listen.
Last week,
if I were writing the Bill of Rights now, there wouldn't be any such thing as the Second Amendment.
Which says?
That a well-regulated militia being necessary for the defense of the state, the people's rights to bear arms. This has been the subject of one of the greatest pieces of fraud, I repeat the word fraud, on the American public by special interest groups that I have ever seen in my lifetime. Now just look at those words. There are only three lines to that amendment. A well-regulated militia. If the militia, which was going to be the state army, was going to be well-regulated, why shouldn't 16 and 17 and 18 or any other age persons be regulated in the use of arms the way an automobile is regulated?
Again, that's Chief Justice Warren Burger calling it a fraud being perpetrated on the American people. We can have our Second Amendment rights and we can safely bear arms in a manner that doesn't place our children at risk. Again, that from Chief Justice Burger. This reporting today from the New York Times on the remediation of PFAS, a forever chemical that has been scientifically proven to cause cancer. Early this year, Stephen Cook was a lawyer that was representing chemical companies, you know, the ones selling the forever chemicals. And he was suing the federal government to block a new rule that would force chemical companies to clean up pollution from the forever chemicals that they manufactured and sold, despite safety concerns, which they knew decades ago. Now, Mr. Cook is in a senior role at the EPA, where he has proposed scrapping that same rule. His former clients were challenging in court. Folks, this is the epitome of the swamp, where a guy who is lobbying and suing to help his deep-pocketed billionaire chemical companies make all of us sicker is now the guy in charge of the rules that would regulate those same companies that he worked for. This should never be allowed in government. This is why people don't trust government. It is an abomination, and it will make all of us sicker and less healthy. There's so many more headlines to get to. We will do that in the course of the show. But coming up next, I'm really excited to bring on Heidi Shareholtz, the president of the Economic Policy Institute. We're going to talk about an independent Fed and the lies being peddled by Vice President Vance in La Crosse today. Keep it locked. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. At least Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce are having a good week. I guess that's about all I can say about it. Welcome back, everybody. And a big hearty welcome to Heidi Shareholtz, the president of the Economic Policy Institute, which is a nonprofit, nonpartisan think tank that uses independent research on economic trends and the impact of economic policies to help advance reforms that lift up the middle class, the engine of the U.S. economy. Heidi, we've got Vice President J.D. Vance in La Crosse, Wisconsin today. He's basically on a PR tour for the big brutal bill, trying to convince everybody with platitudes that say very little and deal not a whit with facts and circumstances as they actually are here on Earth One. This was one of his many stops earlier. He's been in Georgia and Pennsylvania and Ohio. Big surprise, the swing states. He also made a similar visit to a steel mill in South Carolina in May, calling the big brutal bill the beginning of a, quote, industrial renaissance and the golden age of manufacturing. People voted for Donald Trump because I think some of them genuinely believed it would bring back that period of time from the 60s, 70s, and 80s where we had incredibly robust, large-scale manufacturing that provided jobs, that paid a salary, where it would support an entire family. We don't largely have that in many respects anymore. Here's another quote from what Mr. Vance said this afternoon. This, again, in reference to the big, brutal bill. It will let you keep more money in your pocket. It makes it easy for you to take home more of your hard-earned pay, and it makes it easier if you're an American manufacturer, an American business, to build your facility or expand it. Is any of this true? What's actually going on here?
Yeah, it is so not true. So this bill, like the key things that it does is it absolutely guts Medicaid. 15 million people will lose their health insurance. It absolutely slashes food aid for vulnerable families. Tens of millions will get less help buying their groceries or lose help altogether. And it does all that just to give tax breaks that will go overwhelmingly to the rich. So when he's saying you're going to have more money left over to spend because you will pay less in taxes, he's meaning the billionaires are the ones who are going to have more money. So just to give you a sense of what that is, the tax breaks for all but the wealthy are paltry. So families making around $50,000 or less will, on average, pay about $300 less in taxes per year as a result of the big brutal bill. Those who earn around $3 million or more will, on average, get a windfall of more than $100,000 per year as a result of this bill. It's just outrageous. It is so unbelievably tilted towards the super rich. And then the other thing, the tax breaks for the rich are so huge that even after gutting aid for the most vulnerable, the bill still adds $4 trillion to the national debt. It's just like, to give you an idea of the scope of that, that's enough money to give every adult and child in the US a $12,000 check. Like, imagine if every family of five got a $60,000 check. We could absolutely do that instead of the massive tax cuts that they're giving to the very rich. It's just outrageous.
And I want to be sure people know who we're talking about when we're talking about the ultra wealthy. Again, I've gone to great lengths on this program because there are a lot of folks, especially in the state of Wisconsin, work really hard, save, budget, put a nest egg together for their retirement, maybe help their kids go to college, pay for that, maybe even want to help their kids buy their first homes. We're not talking about folks, if you're out there listening to us, that you might feel well-to-do. You can take vacations. Maybe you don't have to manage every penny. We're not talking about you. The ultra wealthy that Heidi and I are talking about, who will reap by far in scales the benefit of the big brutal bill, are the ultra, ultra wealthy. We're talking about people with 50 mil or more in the bank, folks that make millions a year, and most of all, the people that own the companies that we all work for. That's who we're talking about.
Yep, that's right. That's totally right. And then the other thing that I think is worth pointing out in the big brutal bill is the massive deportation, the massive funding of ICE that's in there. It makes ICE so that it is three times as big as the FBI. It is bigger than the entire armies of most countries on this globe with the additional funding that was in the big bill. It funds internment camps. It funds mass surveillance. It funds, obviously, mass deportation things. It is an absolute page out of an autocratic playbook. Like, it is.
And Heidi, here we can say, I don't think progressives or folks that are concerned about these issues, that there's any dispute that if someone is a violent criminal and is here illegally, nobody's saying that person should stay. Nope, they should be deported, right? Like, there's not argument about that. And there's not argument about wanting safe streets. Or even at the most base line to say that someone who is able-bodied, who is not caring for someone else on a full-time basis, should be working in order to receive some of these benefits. Those things have already happened. What we're talking about in this brutal bill is the fact that those have been used as fig leaves to distract you from a giveaway, the putting of the government's hand into your pocket, stealing from working people to give to folks that don't need a whit of your hard-earned money and effort. That's Heidi, exactly. Thank you so much for coming today. So much news to cover. We'll have you back again soon. Folks, you're going to want to stay tuned. Up next, Aurelia Glass of the Center for American Progress Action Fund talking workers' rights in advance of Labor Day. I'm Maggie Dawn. This is the Civic Media Radio Network. Welcome back, everybody, and welcome. Happy Thursday afternoon. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Oh, our Brewers, poor Brewers, dropped one 6-4 to the Diamondbacks this afternoon at AmFam Field. I think they just need a break. I don't know about you. We're going to continue, however, on this fine program to talk about the lies being peddled by Vice President J.D. Vance this afternoon in La Crosse about the big brutal bill and Donald Trump's attacks on workers, not just in federal government, but workers everywhere. And by workers, if you're listening to this program, I mean you. Even if you are a small business owner, I also mean you. Here to help us understand about all of this is Aurelia Glass, a policy analyst and with the American Worker Project, with the Center for American Progress Action Fund. It's a big mouthful trying to get out cleanly. She has formerly worked as a mechanical engineer and pursued a master's in international economics and finance from Johns Hopkins School for Advanced International Studies, one of the best in the country for policy analysis. Welcome to the program, Aurelia. Thanks so much for making time.
Yeah, great. Thanks for having me on, Maggie. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. We've seen Donald Trump unilaterally strip collective bargaining rights from workers in the federal government, but it's much, much broader than his attacks on objective, independent civil servants and science. It gets into the private sector. And while it has been certainly a pillar of the Republican Party since Nixon's time to effectively attack both workers and organized labor, Donald Trump has really turned it up a few notches, I would say, including terminating folks off of the National Labor Relations Board and cutting the minimum wage for thousands of federal workers. What do these attacks mean in real terms for everyday Wisconsinites that get paychecks and have bosses?
Yeah, I mean, you have everything just right. Like, we need unions and we need basic labor protections. They're not just what brought you, you know, Labor Day cookouts on Labor Day weekend. They're what keep you from getting ripped off by your bosses at work. You know, imagine going to work one day and not knowing if you can take the vacation that you had planned, not knowing whether or not you'll get the overtime pay that you won as part of your contract. You know, those are the kind of questions that the federal workers, 1 million federal workers who lost their collective bargaining rights under the administration's actions are having to ask themselves right now. And since the administration is trying to rip up union contracts, like as we speak, this is still ongoing. And the administration's attacks hurt the American public too. You know, the Veterans Administration earlier this month announced that it would end its collective bargaining agreements. And one of those contracts protects nurses who are whistleblowers, you know, who speak up about patient abuse at VA hospitals as something they've done in the past. And, you know, now are those workers going to have to ask themselves whether they feel comfortable being whistleblowers when they witness wrongdoing that hurts veterans when they no longer have those kinds of protections?
The whistleblower point and worker protections when workers speak out in employment circumstances, I don't think can really be overstated. And I want to be really clear about what this means, folks. Many of us, maybe even most of us talking today and listening and thinking about this, have likely worked in a non-unionized capacity. And we know that when you are not represented by a union, you will risk vacation time and maybe even your job or your salary level or possibly get demoted if you speak out in any way, shape, or form questioning your bosses or the company. I think a lot of workers actually live in some kind of fear.
And certainly I understand that bosses want folks to be loyal. But when we talk about this in the particular context of government agencies and whistleblower protections, it is particularly pernicious. We want employees in government agencies to be able to speak out if they see things that are concerning to them. And it's why we used to have independent inspectors general and things along these lines, Aurelia. When that translates for the generalized attacks on workers, can you help just draw those connections a little bit for people? Like, why does it matter to someone who doesn't work in federal government or has never worked in government and may never work in government that Donald Trump has been so aggressively anti-worker in the federal government structure?
Well, one thing that's also key to understand is that this isn't just about federal workers. I mean, as you laid out, those attacks are bad enough on their own, but these attacks are coming from all over the administration, and they're affecting workers who aren't in unions and workers in the private sector too. You know, the Trump administration is even going after the minimum wage. This is the most basic labor protection that workers have in the U.S. The day after Labor Day, it's going to move forward in the next step in a process that'll end minimum wage and overtime protections for almost 4 million home care workers. You know, that's just one industry. It's difficult enough to find workers to provide home care for the elderly, you know, for the disabled in the home, but surely that's not going to get any easier once those workers don't have basic minimum wage protections.
And what is the, how are they making that work? What's the argument that they can strip minimum wage and overtime protections from home healthcare workers?
Well, it's important to understand a lot of these things, you know, they don't need to go through Congress necessarily to pass bills to make some of these things happen. You know, a lot of the authority for it is in the hands of the administration. And it's why it's important for workers to, you know, to be aware of this and to speak out against these attacks on, again, our most basic wage protections and against unions.
Folks, if you're just joining us again, we're joined by Aurelia Glass. She's with the Center for American Progress Action Fund. She works in their American Worker Project. Aurelia, as we work up to Labor Day, and you've recently written on this, and we look at the actions from Trump's first term to his second term, including these rules that will potentially allow employers to steal tips, the gaming of the tipping system, if you will. I'm going to call the gamesmanship that is potentially available when it comes to overtime and how it'd be nice if your overtime maybe wasn't taxed, but that requires you to actually be entitled to overtime and your boss to pay it, your company to pay it. Tell us how this is different from Trump in his first administration. And can you share a little bit more how you are looking at or trying to judge objectively whether or not Donald Trump's policies are actually helping regular middle class and working families across the country?
I mean, it's a pretty stark difference. You know, in the first administration, we didn't have, you know, again, a million federal workers wondering if they're going to have organizing rights anymore. And as far as evaluating what the administration is actually doing, it would have been easier to say, you know, see whether or not wages for working class people are really going up or not. But, you know, after the firing of the Bureau of Labor Statistics Commissioner, after the agency released, again, truthful job figures, that might not be as easy to evaluate. You know, we have to look at what the administration is actually doing. Is it strengthening basic labor protections like the minimum wage, or is it weakening those standards? Is it strengthening organizing rights, or is it attacking unions? And so far, the administration has clearly been on the offense against, again, these very basic organizing rights and basic labor protections in the U.S.
Aurelia, one of the things that I frequently remind listeners to the show about is what I call the most fundamental piece of, quote, the social contract. And in a capitalistic democracy, the social contract between employee and employer, or business owner and working folks that work in those businesses, is that if you work hard and as productivity increases, so will real wages. On a micro level, right, if somebody's willing to work 40 or 50 hours or 60 or whatever we say is a reasonable amount of good hard work in a week, they should be able to live with basic human dignity. Those are the pillars of the social contract. And the particular statistic that I frequently cite to folks is from 1973 to 2014, worker productivity in this country went up somewhere in the ballpark of 92%. And over that same time, we actually saw real wage growth. It was a little bit lower than that, but it was robust. It was somewhere in the high 80s, early 90s, 90%. That's what you expect. That's the social contract working. Now, we can talk about groups that were left behind, largely by virtue of very specific federal laws that exempted folks, and that was an abomination and it remains so today. But just looking at that basic social contract, but when we move forward from 2014, into the 80s, but when we move forward, we look at that same productivity statistics, and again, worker productivity in the 90 plus ranges, and now real wage growth is de minimis. In other words, we continue to produce more for all of the business owners, but we're not seeing that return in real wage growth. To me, that is the promise that has been broken to American workers. And I have seen nothing from Donald Trump that's going to make that fundamental problem get any better. When we look at some of the factors that we can use to assess whether or not working people are getting better, in addition to real wage growth, what are some of the other facts that you have looked at in your study for the Center for American Progress Action Fund?
You know, there's a lot of other things, again, you consider. It's just this basic question of, is the administration doing the right thing in order to try to make it easier to unionize? Is it doing the right thing to try to strengthen and, you know, increase the number of people who are protected by our most basic labor laws? Or is it trying to take those away from people?
Yeah, and that, to me, if we lined up sort of a timeline of the laws that are designed to protect workers, and again, I always tell people, when you think about how you live your day-to-day life, the Monday through Friday work week, the 7 to 4, 8 to 5, or 9 to 6, all of these elements that are so much a part of many folks' workaday world, even if you're a second or third shift worker, those came about because of labor laws coming out of the Gilded Age and the Great Depression. It was through organized labor that the very fabric and contours of our modern work weeks were established. It's those things that Donald Trump and his MAGA colleagues are attacking now. What do we think our lives will look like if this pattern continues in another 20 years? Consider, for example, child labor. They want to get rid of child labor restrictions. I mean, oh my gosh, we're not talking about Sally or Johnny wanting to cut lawns for a little extra pocket money. We're talking about kids working full-time jobs and what that means when our minimum wage is only at 7.25. When we start turning to Wisconsin, Aurelia, what kind of economic reforms do you think leaders in states should be looking at in the face of these attacks by the Trump administration and MAGA leaders in Congress?
Yeah, it's a great question. This is a key moment for state leaders to really step up and take action, you know, that can increase wages and enhance the right and protect the right to organize for people. State laws really do make a big difference. When Wisconsin passed Act 10, which virtually eliminated collective bargaining rights for most public sector workers, you know, you saw the effects of that. The share of inexperienced teachers in schools went up. That's not the kind of thing that state lawmakers, you know, they shouldn't be trying to follow the example of what the administration is doing. Instead, they should be working to expand organizing rights and cement basic standards that make it easier for workers to be able to come together and negotiate. You know, that's what a lot of states are currently working on right now, a lot of really innovative models to expand bargaining rights to people who have really struggled with access to them. You know, the law is just stacked against, the deck is just stacked against them, like with fast food workers or with people like rideshare drivers.
Folks, when we come back, we're going to talk about the gig economy and some of these innovations to help make it easier for workers to organize with my special guest, Aurelia Glass from the Center for American Progress Action Fund. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back here on the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Back, everybody. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. My special guest this half hour is Aurelia Glass with the Center for American Progress Action Fund. If you've listened to this program for a while, you know that I talk about the figure $51 trillion all the time. $51 trillion, which is the amount that I'm going to say the top 1%, folks that earn millions a year, have stolen from working folks in this country from 1981 until about 2021. It's gotten worse since then. But $50 trillion from the bottom 90% of us to the top 1%, so that's like folks that make less than $200,000 a year to folks that make millions a year. That's how much wealth we've lost. We have greater wealth inequality in this country today than we had back in the time of the J.D. Rockefellers and the Astors and the Carnegies, you know, the people with their names on buildings and stuff. More now than we have then. And the big, brutal bill just gave all of those Rockefellers and Astors and Carnegies and Bezoses and Elon Musks of the world billions and billions in tax cuts. When again, we've seen real wage growth stagnating and it looks to be getting worse. Aurelia, one of the great fallacies that I see Republicans doing, and I'm going to call it a shell game, is when they're talking about the big brutal bill, they will just narrowly focus on tax impacts for very select groups to try to at least maybe tell the truth about a tiny portion of the bill, right? And when Democrats or progressives talk about it, they talk about it on sort of a net benefit or cost basis to average families. So what I mean to say by all of this, folks, is you really want to look at, when you're talking about the impacts of the big brutal bill, both if you think you may be getting a tax benefit, okay, that's great, but at the same time, are you paying more for all of the things that are essential to your family's well-being? And the economic reality is that it's only the net result that matters to us, right? Because that's how we experience our family's paychecks and financial well-being. And when you look at the big brutal bill, especially in conjunction with the tariff terror, what we know is that on a net basis, unless you are making caboodles and caboodles and millions and millions and millions of dollars a year, you are nearly certainly going to be economically worse off now and going forward than you were before Donald Trump entered his second term. This is being exacerbated, accelerated, made worse, maybe being locked into our system, or at least that's the attempts by MAGA, by weakening labor and weakening the legal protections for workers across this country. These things run in tandem, right? We can't create the oligarchy if we don't suppress workers' rights, and specifically workers' rights to organize. We now have more people doing gig work, like driving Ubers and Lyfts or walking dogs, that kind of thing. And all of us lead to the question that Aurelia was getting to right before our break, which is there are some innovative reforms to help protect what is one of our most fundamental freedoms, and that is the freedom of association, which is what organized labor is. So with that lengthy preview, Aurelia, tell us, what are some of these innovative reforms that we should be looking to, and perhaps some models from other states?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up rideshare, because to me, rideshare drivers are such a good example of a kind of industry that's both very difficult for workers to organize in. And as a matter of fact, rideshare drivers who are independent contractors don't have any federal organizing rights to come together in unions. It's both a very difficult industry to organize, but it's also one where there's a lot of opportunity for state lawmakers to implement, you know, policies that can actually strengthen organizing rights and really give these workers a meaningful chance to be able to negotiate together for better wages and better working conditions. You know, rideshare drivers, again, there's the issue of being of not being employees, but being independent contractors. But there's also the issue that, you know, very high turnover. There's a lot of concerns over, you know, the use of technologies to surveil workers, you know, and those are very challenging factors to overcome. What some states are doing, Massachusetts recently passed a bill, for instance, California may pass a bill later this year, that are giving workers a way, a legal way, to be able to come together collectively throughout the rideshare industry and to be able to negotiate with their employers in a meaningful way.
It's so critical that these businesses that have been based on and built on this idea of gig work, and there are so many of them now that sort of proliferate our day-to-day lives, that the workers that make the billionaire ownership classes possible with these new companies are actually able to organize. Again, I view this as one of the most central and foundational rights in any democracy, right? It's the right to freely associate with whom you choose, including your fellow workers at work. Aurelia, as we close out this segment, talk right to regular folks in Wisconsin, maybe some of the small business owners, folks that work in many of our state's manufacturing jobs and agricultural jobs that are the engine of our state's economy. What do you want them asking their elected officials about as we look forward to the 2026 midterms?
Look, we need unions. We need basic labor protections. Again, these are the things that brought you the weekend, brought you the 8-hour day. These kinds of things are crucial for workers because without it, you know, again, you might go to work one day and not know whether or not you have that vacation time that you're planning on taking, not knowing whether you're going to get the overtime pay that you wanted. You know, losing our minimum wage standard, again, it's the most basic labor standard that there is for workers in the U.S. So it's really crucial for workers and for people to, you know, insist that the administration put its money where its mouth is and stop attacking unions and stop attacking basic organizing rights. Do something to really strengthen organizing at a time when a lot of working people are really unsure about whether they can make ends meet.
Folks, big thanks to Aurelia Glass of the Center for American Progress Action Fund. Up next, Alex Jacquez, formerly of the White House Economic Council, and the current chief of policy and advocacy at the Groundwork Collaborative. We talk about how much more your school supplies will cost this fall, thanks to Donald Trump.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.